Okay, so I'm actually, after hearing this introduction, very happy that I'm going to give the first talk because I got the easy questions. And I'm just supposed to set the field and basically give an introduction to then the later talks, which will really address the technical difficulties. And so mine is the only fluff talk you're going to hear in this whole meeting. And so, as you heard, we all got a list of questions that we were supposed to address. And I tried to make some sense out of these questions, try to get a framework into these questions. And so I came up with three parts. In the first part, basically give just a general introduction, what is single particle EM good for, what is not good for, how does it intersect with other areas, and why is single particle EM difficult? But Ron basically already explained all this. So and in the second part, I was asked to talk about what is challenging in the past, at the present, and the future. And in the last part, which I actually got by email, I was also asked to talk about what we should actually put into a publication and also what resolution is actually useful. And so the first part is really just a general introduction. And I wanted to start with the question, what is single particle EM really good for? And I think everybody in this room really knows what it's good for. You can actually get structure information from molecules without having the need to crystallize them. And that's really a big deal. Because if you don't have to crystallize, you don't have to deal with all these crystallization issues. You don't have to spend this enormous amount of time to try to actually grow 3D crystals, or in my case, 2D crystals. But because I am at heart an electron crystallographer, I still believe that if you can get the crystals, in many aspects, it's actually better to get a crystal, because we don't have to deal with all these ambiguities whether the structure is correct or not. If you have a crystal, the structure you get is usually correct. But in single particle EM, you have the advantage that you can visualize the molecules outside of a crystal. And that really helps you with a lot of specimens that don't crystallize. So for example, labile complexes, dynamic complexes, it's very difficult to crystallize. Membrane proteins still are difficult to crystallize, but the X-ray people make a lot of progress here. But in a lot of samples, you can simply not produce enough quantity of the protein to really make 3D crystals. And then there's a last category, which is kind of unusual, which I call difficult samples, which you cannot address with any other technique. And I wanted to give you two examples of what I consider difficult samples. So for example, the complex that the proteasome, the 26S proteasome, forms with an activator called PA28. And when we worked on this complex, PA28 did not bind very well to the proteasome. So the only thing we could do is to mix a huge excess of PA28 to the proteasome, throw it in a grid, and then take images. And the images we got were really, really messy. But then, because we have images, we can pick these particles, and then we can actually average these, classify the particles, and we find the proteasome itself. We find the proteasome with 1 and 2 19S regulatory particles. We found the proteasome with 1 or 2 PA28s. And the real complex we were after was the hybrid complex where you have the core particle with the 19S on one side and PA28 on the other side. And that's a minimal fraction of the sample, actually. And to get this kind of structure out of such a sample, you really cannot do with any other technique but single particle electron microscopy. And another kind of difficult sample is if you're interested in a substructure. And so what we were interested in were actin branching sites. And so the comet tail from the steer is actually formed by a complex called the OPT2-3 complex, which initiates and branches actin filaments. And you can reproduce this process in vitro, and you can make these branched actin filaments. And what we were interested in is the structure of these branching sites. And obviously, there's no way that you can crystallize this or that you can try to get the structure by NMR spectroscopy. But in our case, we can just simply define all these branching sites as individual particles, average them, and we get a nice projection average. And if we tilt, we can also calculate a three-dimensional reconstruction of this branching site. And that's really only possible by single particle electron microscopy, or recently this has actually also been done by electron tomography. So in addition to having these not to deal with crystallizing a protein, we can actually also look at the protein in solution. And that's really a big deal because we don't have to deal with crystallization artifacts, which you can have either because of crystal packing or by the crystallization conditions that you use. In addition, if you look at a protein in solution, you can actually see all the different conformations of this molecule, while a crystal usually selects one of the conformations and forms a crystal out of this one. And I wanted to show us a few examples for that. And so this was a major breakthrough. This was a crystal structure of the exocell domain of an integrin. And it showed all the necessary parts, but what was strange was that the head group was kind of wrapped around the leg, or the legs were wrapped around the head group. And that was completely unexpected at the time. And so the crystallographers actually thought that this is an artifact from the crystallization. And they made a model how the integrin should really look like, namely in this extended conformation. Now, we thought that this would actually be a nice inactive form, and this would be a nice active form. And so if we would image the molecule under inactive conditions, we should be able to see this conformation. And indeed, when we did this in presence of calcium magnesium, where we have inactive conditions, you can see very nicely these particles, which we can just pick and then average. And the average is very similar to the crystal structure. And so this is a reprojection from this crystal structure. And so what you can see is that this conformation is actually not a crystal artifact. It does exist in solution. Another example was then they had these crystals of the integrin, had a molecule, and they wanted to activate it. And so they just soaked in a little bit of the ligand, which in this case was an RGD peptide. And they soaked it into the crystal and looked at the crystal structure after soaking, and they found a tiny little difference here shown between red and blue. So there was really not a major difference. But when we did the same, when we took this integrin and took a different ligand, the fibronectin domain 9 and 10, and added it to the protein, what we got was a mixture of molecules, and there was this molecule, which never had the density up here, and then we had another molecule with a density up here, which is actually the fibronectin domain. And what was interesting is that these legs actually completely opened up every time a fibronectin was bound. So ligand binding actually induces a massive conformational change in the molecule, which you simply didn't see in the crystal structure because the crystal packing restrained the molecule so much that it could not be activated. So this is really something nice you can do with single particle electron microscopy. You have no crystal constraints. Another example about crystallization, this is a complex from the death domains of FAS and FAT molecules. This is a complex that has been crystallized and published. And when this structure came out, it was actually quite frustrating to us because we were also working on this complex. But what we realized was that the structure actually didn't look at all like our projection averages, which are shown here. And when we calculated reprojection from this crystal structure, the reprojections didn't look anything like our class averages. And the problem was that this crystal structure was actually, the structure was determined in a buffer at pH 4. And pH 4 is actually known to dissociate this complex. So this was very likely just an artifact. And so we could convince our collaborators to continue to try and crystallize this. And indeed, she was able to crystallize this. This was how Wu's work at pH 8.5, which is much more close to physiological conditions. And then she got this structure. And when we calculated the 3D reconstruction with these class averages, it fit actually quite nicely. So even with this very crummy negative stain projection averages, we can actually try and verify crystal structures and figure out whether they can be or not. And so another example, what is nice about single particle EM, once again, we look at the molecule in solution, and so we can look at all the different conformations of this molecule. And this is the AMPA receptor. This is work from Terunaga Nakagawa in Morgan Sheng's lab. And this is AMPA receptor purified from the brain. And when he picked these particles and calculated class averages, he could see two major different conformations, this more compact conformation and this more open conformation. And then he could calculate 3D reconstructions showing that these are really not just different views of the same molecule, but these are really different molecules, different conformations of the same molecule. And what is nice now is this is untreated specimen, and now we can add, for example, the ligand, which in this case is glutamate, and you can see that we have much less of these compact conformations here and many more of these open conformations. So glutamate actually induces a conformation change. And if we use glutamate in CTZ, which is a chemical that inhibits desensitization, you can see that the conformations actually go back to the untreated sample. And so what is nice is that we can now actually quantify all these different conformations and see how a chemical or a ligand actually affects the equilibrium between the different conformations. And that's something you can really only do by single particle EM, not by a crystallographic technique. And so, beside all this crystallization advantages that we don't have to crystallize and we don't have crystallization artifacts, another big advantage of single particle EM is that we have no size limitations. We can look at very, very large complexes, and that's obviously very different, for example, from NMR spectroscopy. So this is what EM is good for. What is it not good for? What can we not do by single particle EM? And that's actually a difficult question because we can do a hell of a lot. It's an extremely versatile technique, and we can look at many, many different types of specimens. And the only two conditions that we really have to fulfill is, first of all, we have to be able to see the molecule in the image. If we don't see the molecule, we can't do anything. The second condition is that each molecule has to exist in many identical copies. And this doesn't mean that you cannot look at heterogeneous specimens, but if you have different conformations, each conformation has to be present in many different copies. And once only these two requirements are fulfilled, you can basically study any specimen by single particle EM. And that's really a very strong statement, I think. And so what about having molecules that are visible in the image? Obviously, we need to see the images so we can the particles so we can pick them, and the high contrast is also good for alignment and classification of the molecules. And what I wanted to point out is that not only the mass is important, not if you have a 200 kilodalton protein, it doesn't necessarily mean that you will be able to see it. It's really also the shape that defines whether you can see a molecule, because a globular protein with a certain mass is much easier to see than a very extended thin molecule with the same mass. So it's really the mass and the shape, the mass per area, that is important if you will see a protein or not. And then obviously specimen preparation will define whether you will see a protein or not. Smaller molecules, maybe under 200 kilodalton, are very difficult to see by cryo-EM. And so in this case, you have to do negative stain. And actually, most of the specimens that come to my lab are actually smaller than 200 kilodalton. So we use a lot of negative stain EM. And then finally, you can also tweak your instrumentation. You can use a high defocus, which will increase the contrast. You can use an energy filter to get rid of the inelastic scattered electrons. And more recently, there are attempts to get a faceplate, which will really boost the contrast of your images. In terms of the second, a condition that you have to have many different identical copies, many identical copies of your protein. Obviously, we need this because single particle EM really depends on averaging images. And so what this means is that the particles not only have to be chemically identical, but they also have to be structurally identical. And very often, if you work with a biochemist, they come to you with a gel where they show you a very nice band and say, well, this is my protein, it's as pure as can be. And then you try to do something with it, and you see it many different conformations. And that really makes your life hell. So you really depend, if you want to do high resolution, you need structure identical molecules. And so you have conformation equilibriums that make it difficult. And also, if you have complexes, if you have all the complexes in your preparation, it doesn't mean that all the complexes are together in one complex. All the subunits are together in one complex. And then the basic idea is the greater that you have, the greater heterogeneity you have in your sample, the more difficult it becomes to really do single particle EM. If you have limited heterogeneity, maybe just one subunit falls off or just two conformations, you can still do very nice cryo-EM and go to fairly high resolution. However, as you get more and more heterogeneity, it becomes more and more difficult to sort these out into different classes. And so what we do in this case is negative stain EM or cryo-negative stain EM. And if the heterogeneity becomes so big that pretty much every molecule looks different from all the other molecules, averaging is out. And then if you're lucky, you can actually try electron tomography. So how does single particle EM intersect with other areas? And so they gave these topics to me. And how does it intersect with light microscopy? And actually, I have no idea. I really don't know. Doesn't mean there isn't something. I just don't know it. But there are other methods. So electron tomography, of course, does very nicely intersect with light microscopy. And you're probably going to hear from Brand, at least, about correlative microscopy, where you use light microscopy to search the area, which you then use to do an electron tomogram. There's much better interaction between single particle EM and electron tomography. And one of them is averaging of sub-tomograms. So this is work from Cantelo's group where he made a tomogram of an insect flight muscle, and you can see all these unit cells, or these repeating subunits, but they're all slightly different. And so what he did was to cut out each of these branching sites or these contact sites and then classify them and calculate averages of the sub-tomograms. And in the end, was even able to make a pseudatomic model of this interaction. Another way you can combine single particle EM with electron tomography is structural proteomics, which is really pioneered by Wolfgang Baumeister. And the idea is that you create a tomogram, and then you have many different templates, and you search your volume for these templates and see whether you can find them or not, and identify how many of these molecules you actually have in your tomogram. And these templates can come from X-ray crystallography, NMR, and of course from single particle EM. Now, NMR spectroscopy, once again, not a clue. If anybody knows in the audience any interactions between single particle EM and NMR, please let me know. I don't. But there is one thing that we have recently done, but this is single particle EM. One way or another, you can always use it for something. And so recently, Gerhard Wagner determined the structure of the VDAC channel by NMR. And this was done in detergent micelle, and so there was criticism whether the structure in detergent is actually representative of the structure in a lipid bilayer. And so what he did was to reconstitute the VDAC channel into nanodiscs and then asked us to image them. So we did this in negative stain, and you can see that these dark spots are actually the channels of the VDAC in these nanodiscs. And then he calculated, or then he recorded NMR spectra of those, and the spectra looked very, very similar. But this is really just an odd example. But whether it's really a good interaction between NMR spectroscopy and EM is with 2D crystals, because you can actually use the 2D crystals as a specimen for solid-state NMR spectroscopy. And that's really pioneered by Oshkinard together with Werner Kühlbrand. Now, with electron crystallography, which is actually where I come from, there's a lot of interesting interactions between single particle and 2D crystals. And the idea is that you can basically, so this is a crystal that I created a long time ago of the RCLH1 photo unit. And if you take this crystal and you just process it in a purely crystallographic way, what you find is the LH1 ring, and inside is a blur, and this should be the reaction center. And the reason why you have a blur in here is because the reaction center has not a unique orientation within the ring. It can actually adopt many different orientations. And so what we could do is actually to cut out all these individual unit cells and then align the unit cells with respect to each other by single particle methods. And once you do that, you actually see the ring, and now also the RC in the middle starts to have a shape. So this is a special example, but the idea is that in future you might be able to work with very poorly ordered 2D crystals and then cut out the unit cells and improve the resolution of your projection, also of your 3D reconstruction, by applying single particle methods to these individual unit cells. And recently, Nico, together with Henning Stolberg, have really included now maximum likelihood into this approach, and they actually reach a resolution of 3.5 angstrom. So that's very encouraging. That's very promising to use single particle for 2D crystals. And another thing you can also use single particle for is you can always assess the homogeneity of the sample that you want to use for crystallization. Single particle EM is so quick and easy, at least in negative stain and projection, that it can really speed up your crystallization times, because you can check whether your sample is good enough. If it's just a mass, if it's just aggregated, you're not going to try and make 2D crystals out of that. And so in X-ray crystallography, there's also a lot of interactions. So of course, you can once again just assess the homogeneity of the protein solution that you want to use for crystallization. But more interesting, you can actually use the phases of a single particle reconstruction as an initial phase set to then phase a X-ray intensity data set. And this has been done for the ribosome, and I think also for some viruses. And then finally, you can use single particle EM to assess the correctness of crystal structures, as I showed you before, with the integrin structures, the conformation, the activation, and also the FASFAT complex. The most interesting interaction of single particle EM is with any kind of atomic structure, and it really doesn't matter where it comes from, X-ray, NMR, electron crystallography. But as soon as you have X-ray structures, single particle EM becomes much more interesting, at least to me. Because what you can do a 3D reconstruction of a complex, at whatever resolution you get, and then take the crystal structures and dock them into the density map and create so-called pseudo-atomic models without actually having to crystallize the complex itself, which can, under certain circumstances, be very, very difficult. But if you do that, you should keep in mind that you can do this with pretty much any kind of density map, whatever resolution, you can use it to dock crystal structure into the density map. But the docking will be better the better the resolution of the density map. And what you should keep in mind is that these pseudatomic models, although they are very nice, they remain models. They're really just models. And so it's always a good idea, if you can, to verify whether your pseudatomic model is actually correct. You can do this by mutagenesis or all kinds of different types of information, really trying to verify whether your model is correct or not. And so that brings me to the second part, and that's a little bit of history. And the question really is, why is single particle EM difficult? And the thing is that EM is actually pretty good to get atomic resolution. This is an image from Nico's work, and this is an inorganic crystal, and you can see all these white spots are all individual atoms. So EM is perfectly capable of giving you atomic resolution. Why is it so hard for us? And the reason is that biological specimens have really their own unique problems. So first of all, they consist of a lot of water. And if you want to take a specimen and you put it in the microscope, you completely dehydrate it and you get a complete collapse of the structure. So you have to prepare your specimen somehow for the vacuum in the electron microscope. The second problem is that biological specimens consist of very light atoms. And that leads to a very low contrast, and they also become very sensitive to beam damage. And so you have to deal with this. And basically, if you try to take images of biological specimens, first of all, it's very difficult to take good images because the images, really, the quality of the images deteriorates with any kind of movement of your specimen. Specimen drift, charging, beam damage induced movement, anything that moves the specimen is going to kill the quality of your image. In addition, once you take an image, you get an image which is really very, very noisy. And noisy images is not a good thing if you want to align them very accurately. So the question, one of the questions that was asked, how do you record good images? Well, you just try. I really don't know what the answer to that is. Of course, you'd want to optimize the calibration of your instrument, and then top entry specimen stages are much more stable than side entry stages, but you still need to let the specimen stabilize before you take an image. And then for single particles, an old trick by now is that you have to take an edge of the carbon film so that you have conductance to actually get rid of the electrons. And then recently, Nico has introduced LINDO, which is basically taking an image with very low dose and very long exposures. But I think this has become controversial, and I'm not quite sure whether Nico is actually going to discuss this here or not. Nico? I think it's interesting, because I think there's still some controversy. And if anybody has other tricks, I'm actually as interested as you are how you actually take good images. It's for us, it's basically trial and error. And then how do you identify bad images? And the typical way to do this is you check the Fourier transform, and there are different ways to do that. You basically look for the tone rings. The better the image, the further out the tone ring goes. But the problem with this is that it's not really easy to see these tone rings because the signal-to-noise ratio is so low that the tone rings really disappear in the noise. But then later on in the refinement of your structure, you can actually also try to compare the particles of a particular image to your model. And if all the particles really correlate very badly to your model, that would be an indication that that particular image is actually pretty bad and you throw all these particles away. But I think you will hear more about this later on. So basically, taking good images is not so easy, but the higher resolution you want to achieve, the better has to be the quality of the images that you take. And then, what is really the problem that we have? The problem is that we have very noisy images which are distorted by the contrast transfer function. And in addition, we only have projection images, and we are interested in a three-dimensional structure. So to get a 3D structure out of these very crummy images, you have to get a lot of information out of these images. You have to determine the CTF parameters, the defocus, and the astigmatism. You need to determine the 5 orientation parameters, x, y, and the 3 Euler angles. And in addition, you have then to align and classify the particles. So there's a huge amount of information that you have to get out of very poor images, and that's really the problem that you're facing, and that's why computational methods are so important in single particle EM. And so once again, the higher the resolution you want to get with your reconstruction, the more accurate you have to determine these parameters, and that's really the problem in single particle EM. I think everybody agrees with that. And in my view, and as Ron actually already mentioned, my biggest problem with single particle EM is that we have no way to really assess the correctness of a 3D reconstruction. The good thing about single particle EM is that you always get a density map in the end. The bad thing about single particle EM is that you always get a density map in the end. The problem is you just don't know whether it's correct or not, and there's no good criterion in the moment to judge whether it's correct or not. There's not something like R3 or something like that. And even the resolution itself is actually controversial. There are many different ways to determine the resolution. Everybody has a different favorite criterion. And so it's really difficult to really verify that the single particle reconstruction that you get in the end is actually accurate. And that was, for me, a huge problem when I started in the field, because I never trusted the reconstruction that I had in the end. And it took me a lot of time to trust what I actually get in the end. And so what means challenging? And so in the past, and I just define past before sub-nanometer resolution, before 1995, and at that point, pretty much every molecule was really challenging because there was no technique established to get these structures. And so everything had to be developed from scratch. And so the main problems were beam damage, so low-dose techniques had to be developed. You had to find specimen preparation methods, data collection optimization. You had to deal with low signal-to-noise images, so you had to do averaging. You had to find methods to do alignment classification. And then, of course, you only had projection images, so you had to find ways to determine the orientation and to calculate 3D reconstruction and to refine. So there was a lot of stuff that you had to establish to get from images to 3D reconstructions. And so specimen preparation, initially everything was done in negative stain. And I'm still a big fan of negative stain because it really gives you a very good contrast. You can actually really see your particles, and that's something that makes me feel very good about it. But the problem is, of course, that your resolution is limited to 20 angstrom, although Holger might disagree. Holger, are you going to talk about you? If you don't talk about it, Holger actually got a 9 angstrom structure out of negative stain, which is pretty impressive. So the other problem with negative staining is that you have artifacts. You get flattening deformation when you adsorb to the carbon film. You get incomplete stain embedding. So it becomes difficult to trust your 3D reconstruction in the end. But if you know what you're dealing with, you can actually have an idea whether your reconstruction is correct or not. But then, obviously, the big breakthrough in the field came with vitrification in Jacques Dubosc's lab. Mark Adrian had developed this. And now you have really a very native preservation of your specimen. The problem is you end up with very poor contrast. And that actually creates a size limitation, because if your molecule becomes too small, it doesn't scatter enough electrons that you're actually able to see it in the eyes. So now you have a size limitation. The other problem is, kind of problem, it can be an advantage, it can be a problem, is that you end up with randomly distributed orientations of your molecules in the eyes layer. What is nice about negative staining is that very often you induce a preferred orientation of your molecule on the grid. So if two molecules look different, you can basically say they're most likely two different conformations. In ice, once you have random orientations, if two images look dissimilar, you no longer know whether this is due because you have different orientations of the molecule, you look at different views of the molecule, or whether you have two molecules in different conformations. So ice has really made the problem a lot more difficult. Then once vitrification has been introduced, you had to find low-dose procedures which have been introduced, and then also you have to develop specimen holders that can actually keep the grid frozen in the electron microscope, and this is the design that Richard actually proposed, and it was used for a long time, which I actually didn't know that you did this. I was an electron crystallographer. I joined the field pretty late, but in the meantime, I think now these holders are being more and more replaced by top entry stages, which are much more stable. And then once you took your images, you had to do a lot of image processing. I'm not going to talk about this at all because you will hear a lot about different alignment classification methods and then the different 3D reconstruction methods and also refinements. So I'm going to just skip about this. So what was possible at that time? Pretty much 3D reconstruction at a molecular resolution of large homogeneous and preferably symmetric molecules. That was what was really possible in 1995. And just to give you some examples, viruses were a big deal. So you had around 25 angstrom, the virus, and then you could decorate them with antibodies and see where the antibody binds to the virus. You could look at the RNA inside of the virus. Then the ribosome, Joachim Frank, who really pioneered most of these single particle methods, gave you some first insights into translation. A very early specimen was also the calcium release channel, the ryanodine receptor. And this is a random conical tilt reconstruction. This is actually the first example of angular reconstitution done with the ryanodine receptor. And also Helen Sable's work on the Groyel-Groyes complex, giving you first ideas about the cycle, the conformational cycle of this complex. And then also from the MOC, you had the first structure of the Clathrin code at 21 angstroms. So what was possible were basically molecular reconstructions, molecular resolution reconstructions of large molecules. What was challenging at the time was anything better than molecular resolution, even for ideal specimens like viruses, Clathrin cages, these kind of things. And any 3D reconstruction of small, asymmetric, or complex of a structural heterogeneity were a real problem at that time. And what Nico pointed out to me was that one of the major limitations at the time was actually computing power. Even if you had good ideas how to deal with these problems, the computers just didn't allow you to do that in 1995. So this is where the field stood in 1995. Basically, you could see blobs. Interesting, but blobs. And then, for some reason, Richard had the nerve to basically say that EM should be able to give you atomic structures of molecules as long as they have a certain size. I was still in electron crystallography when this paper came out, and I basically just thought, yeah, you wish. So you should never believe me with prospect. Huh? Well, you're closer. But anyway, what really happened then was the introduction of field emission guns, and you got a much brighter, much more coherent beam, envelope function became better, and you could actually collect higher resolution data, and now you also had to deal with CTF correction. And then in 1997, two very important structures came out of the hepatitis B virus for the hepatitis B virus. And this was the first sub-nanometer resolution structure ever obtained by single particle EM. And I think this will encourage a lot of people that you can actually really get a lot of information out of images. And so now more people got involved in single particle EM, and the problems were still the same. You still had to deal with beam damage, slow signal, the noise images, and you still only had projection images. But then people try to make progress. Specimen preparation is not a good example. Vitrification is still the best way to do it. But cryonegative staining came along, which also allows you to get density maps of sub-nanometer resolution sometimes. It basically combines the high contrast of the stain with the few artifacts that you get from freezing. But the resolution in many cases is still limited. And if you think making cryo vitrified specimens is difficult, try to make a cryonegative stain image specimen. That's really pretty much the most tedious, the most difficult specimen preparation you can think of. So that's not a cheap way. That's actually really quite difficult. And then Holger actually came up with graphics, which is a very nice method to stabilize the complexes, and you get much nicer images of the complexes. But it's actually not good for every specimen. We found that long extended complexes basically just collapse into a ball, and so you don't want to do graphics with that. But for globular complexes, this is a wonderful method, and we now use it actually a lot. And then we did recently the monolayer purification and affinity grid, and the idea of this method is just to make the purification really fast and really easy, and to don't give the protein, the complex, time to disassemble, to fall apart. And it also protects the complex from the air-water interface, so you don't have the problem with the surface tension. But once again, these methods, once again, not good for every specimen. Quite often, we have problems with that. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about this in one of the discussion sections. So data collection, progress has been made. A lot of progress has been made with data collection. So CCD cameras came into the picture, which really sped up the imaging. Energy filters help to reduce the background noise. Top entry stages really stabilized the specimen. Helium cooling is kind of not very well accepted in the field, I guess. For 2D crystals, I still believe it's very good. And then Linda, which I mentioned before, might be good, but there's some doubt whether this works, and I think it's actually good to discuss it. And then, of course, out of here, Bridget and Clint, automation of the data collection, which now allows you to collect a huge amount of data much more quickly. And then also image processing, a lot of stuff has been done. I'm not going to talk about it, but a lot has been done with heterogeneity, and you will hear a lot about this. Fred Sigworth and Jose Maria Carazza have introduced maximum likelihood, which has become very powerful. GPU processing really speeds up the processing, that, so now you can actually deal with these large data sets. And then also image processing has been automated. And I think at least for easy particles, it works quite nicely. So success stories. I think seeing a particle EM at this point is really quite remarkable. And now there are really structures at near atomic resolution. So this is work from Marchu's lab, where you have a density map where you can really trace the backbone. Hong Zhou's wonderful structure at 3.88 angstroms, which is very impressive. And then also Nico's work, and you can really now see very nicely the side chains. And these density maps I would never have believed possible even 10 years ago. So that's really remarkable. Now, also, the not virus particles have made a lot of progress. And so I show you the same examples as before. The ribosome, which was at 25 angstrom, now is at 6.7 angstrom. And with the crystal structure, Joachim could actually now do flexible fitting and actually look at very detailed mechanistic problems in the ribosome, which is very impressive. And this is Roland Beckman's work on the signal recognition particle. Again, it's sub-nanometer resolution, both the mammalian the E. coli complex and the mammalian complex. And then also from Christian Spahn's group, this is a ribosome with an iris RNA bound to it. And what is interesting about this work is that actually for the first time, an RNA structure was deduced from the density in a 3D reconstruction. And then the calcium release channel has made a lot of progress, again, close to nanometer resolution. This is Wat Chu, and what he did in this case is to use secondary structure element hunter to actually try and identify all the alpha helices in this huge protein. And Montserrat Samsa also works on calcium release channels. She is also about 10 angstroms. And what she is looking at is actually opening and the closing of the calcium release channel. And then the Groyel has made a huge progress. So this is work from here, where they have collected almost 300,000 particles. For somebody like me who is picking particles by hand, this is just a crazy number. But with 300,000 particles, all automatically collected, and also the image processing completely automatically done, and still they get some nanometer resolution, which is really quite impressive. And then also Helen Sable has continued. And what she has done is she went away from the seven-fold symmetrization, now looks at the Groyel without symmetrization, no symmetry imposed. And what she can do now is to look actually at the substrate binding to the Groyel structure. And then finally, from Wachu's lab again, this is the Groyel close to 4 angstroms. And so once again, this is now not a virus, but you get to a resolution where you can start to trace the backbone. The Clathrin cage, we got to 8 angstrom. This is a collaboration from our group together with Niko Grigoryev and Steve Harrison, and we got the resolution good enough that we could actually build a pseudatomic model of the Clathrin cage. And now some new examples. This is work from Yifan Cheng's lab. This is a structure of the proteasome, and what I find really remarkable is that in this proteasome, he bound a peptide which is 8 amino acids long, and he was actually able to identify this density for these 8 amino acids, which is really amazing to me. I would never have thought that this is possible. And then our structure of the transferrin receptor transferrin complex, what is kind of special about this is it's a fairly small molecule, only about 300 kilodalton, and only 2-fold symmetry. So cryo-EM is also making progress towards smaller molecules. So what is possible at this time, I think, is 3D reconstruction, near atomic resolution of viruses, very large, stable molecules with a high symmetry. We can also get 3D reconstruction at sub-nanometer resolution of homogeneous complexes, preferably with high symmetry, such as Gruyelle and Clathrin cages. And then quite regularly, we can also get 3D reconstruction at molecular resolution or better of heterogeneous complexes, heterogeneous samples. What remains difficult to this day is trying to get near atomic resolution with complexes that do not have a high symmetry, and also small proteins. That remains very challenging. And 3D reconstructions, even at sub-nanometer resolution of very heterogeneous specimens, is still a major challenge, and I think that's going to be the major topic of this workshop, how to try and deal with this heterogeneity issue. And so what are current developments? Again, I'm only going to give a brief overview. One of the big areas of developments are trying to get new detectors, so you can actually collect images with a better signal-to-noise ratio. So you get more contrast, and this helps you with the alignment and the classification. The same with the faceplate. If it ever works, it's going to give you very high contrast images, very good for alignment and classification. Then a new development is dynamic TEM. The idea of dynamic TEM is that you take a very, very high electron dose, and you take a very, very brief exposure so that you get all your information out of your molecule before you completely burn it to coal. And that is very exciting, but I'm not quite sure where it stands. Bob, are you going to talk about this? Are you going to talk about it? No?
It doesn't exist. It works.
Current developments.
Give me a card.
I'll give you a card. And then I think a new development is collecting these humongous data sets. And that's probably something we will have to do to be able to deal with this heterogeneity issue. And then, of course, new image processing algorithms. I don't think we are done with image processing algorithms. I hope that people like you, you're going to talk about a lot of this stuff, right? Yeah, anyway, I don't try anymore. But in addition, what is currently being developed, what I really think we desperately need, and I don't know anybody working on it, and something that I really would like, is to get a reliable resolution criterion, and maybe Nikos or measure is one way to get a reliable resolution for your 3D reconstruction. And the most important issue in my brain is still trying to get an objective criterion to figure out whether your 3D reconstruction is correct or not. That would really make my life a lot easier if I would have something that would tell me whether I can believe my reconstruction or not. And so prospects for single particle EM, and quite honestly, ask Richard. And luckily enough, he's the next talk, so please. In my view, what I've figured out so far is that viruses are really leading the way. Viruses were the first molecules where you got molecular reconstructions, then you got sub-nanometer resolution, and now you had near atomic resolution. And it seems that the big macromolecular complexes are always following behind. So I think we will get to near atomic resolution with large molecules with high symmetry. For example, Gruyelle is actually very close. Then eventually, I think the ribosome large complexes will also get to high resolution, near atomic resolution. Eventually, if faceplates and all this come true, maybe we can get smaller molecules to near atomic resolution. And then molecules with very high heterogeneity, I think that's very far in the future. I don't think that is going to be feasible very soon, but Richard will tell you more about this. So the question is, do we really need near atomic resolution? And I think that was actually a very good question. Whoever asked this question, I actually really like that. I don't think near atomic resolution is going to be the future of Singapore or the major role of single particle EM. I really think that if we can get molecular envelopes, preferably at near atomic at sub nanometer resolution, and can combine this with crystal structures of the subunits, that is really what makes single particle EM unique and would make it really, really versatile, because you can produce the pseudatomic models and you can actually gain insights into the conformation changes that are associated with the functional changes of a complex. And I think that's my personal opinion, that this is going to be the major role of single particle EM in the future. And so in the last part, just some other considerations. So the question that was asked of me is what resolution is useful? And I think this is already the wrong question to ask. What is really the question, what information is useful? The resolution is secondary, in my opinion. So there are the typical resolution steps above 15 angstrom. You have molecular envelopes. At 10 angstroms, you see alpha helices, 4.5 beta sheets, 3.5 near atomic resolution side chains. And about 1.5, you get to real atomic resolution. But the resolution, in my opinion, is secondary. What you really want to know is also, do you actually need a 3D reconstruction? Or do you get away with a 2D average? And also, do you need to have a perfect preservation? Do you need a vitrified specimen, completely native, or can you use negative staining, or can you use cryo-negative staining, or can you chemically fix your specimen? And so my view of the whole thing, and I'm a biologist much more than an electron microscopist, is that if you can make a 3D reconstruction at near atomic resolution of a native specimen in vitrified ice, unfixed, of course, this will give you the best information, all the information you want. But that's really not always actually very rarely possible. And in my opinion, it's not always necessary. You really have to figure out whether the question that you want to answer really needs atomic resolution. And so in my view, useful information really depends exclusively on the biological question that you try to answer. And in some cases, projection averages of negatively stained samples is really all you need, all you can do, but also all you need to do. And I have to say, that's really my personal opinion. It's not shared by most of the reviewers that are going to look at your papers. But when you have crystal structures and you want to understand how proteins come together to form a complex, sometimes you can see this very effectively in projections, in negative stain. You can learn all you need to learn without spending years and decades to make a near atomic resolution structure nice. So I think it's not always necessary and actually not reasonable to go to very, very high resolutions. And so the last point that I'm trying to make is what I was asked by email, so you won't find this in the handout. I got an email telling me I should talk about what I want to see in publications about single particles. And what I really want to see when I referee papers is always I want to see the raw data. You don't need to put it in the main text, but have at least a supplementary figure where you show your images, because that's very important for the referee to judge the quality of your data. And if you have an eye structure, of course, you show the vitrified specimen, but personally, I very much like to see negatively stained specimens, because in eyes, the contrast is so bad that I'm not able to judge how homogeneous this preparation is. If you show me a negative stain image, I can actually judge much better how homogeneous your preparation is and how reasonable the image processing is that you did. So I am actually a big fan of negative staining, as you might realize. And then obviously you want to show class averages. Many publications, you only find the class average that show what you want to see. I quite like to show all the class averages in the supplementary material so that the reviewer can see all the class averages and not just the ones that show what I want to show. And then obviously you want to show the 3D reconstruction. And potentially, if you do that, in our case, we always do a random conical tilt reconstruction in the beginning. We tend to show this also as supplementary material. And then very important, I think it's important to really show all the quality control issues. You want to show the FSC curve, that it has a nice curve. You can include all measure, and I think that's something that the community should discuss, whether we actually want to try and think about all measures as one of a general resolution criterion. Then you want to show the angular distribution just to make sure that you have all the different views that you need to completely define your 3D reconstruction. And then you want to show comparisons between the raw image, the class averages, and the reprojections just to make sure that the 3D reconstruction is actually consistent with the projection data. And then in the end, obviously, what we all want to show are interpretations. So we show docking of crystal structure into the density map, labeling data. Once again, I think it's perfectly fine if you show labeling data in negative stain. But recently I was asked, we did 13 labeling, 13 subunits of a complex we labeled in negative stain. And the referee told us we should do all the labeling in ice and 3D. And I'm really not sure whether this makes sense or not. And then finally, variance maps, any kind of other information you can show. And so just an example, so this is a publication we did on at APC, NFOs promoting complex. So we first did a negative stain, we did tilt pairs, we showed all the class averages, we showed the resolution curve for negative stain. Then we got a lot of flattening, so that's why we did cryo-negative staining, again a tilt pair in cryo-negative stain. This time, all the averages in cryo-negative stain, you can see that a lot of the particles are actually pretty bad. They get squashed between the carbon grids, but some of them are actually good, which are the ones we use for 3D reconstruction. And then we obviously also went to ice. So this is the ice image, all the averages that we got for the vitrified specimen. And then all the different 3D reconstruction we did in negative stain, you can see it's flattened. In cryo-negative stain, we don't have so much flattening. Then we used this 3D reconstruction, which we got by random conical tilt, as a model to align the ice images and free align. So this is one 3D reconstruction that we got. But because there were conflicting structures out there, we decided to make complete a different 3D reconstruction. So this is a 3D reconstruction that we calculated de novo without an initial model, and they actually look pretty similar. So in the end, we show all the resolution curves, the Fourier shell correlation curves for all the different reconstructions. We show the angular angular distribution. You can see we actually had a major issue with preferred orientation, so that's why we included some tilt images, so we can spread out the information a little bit. And then in the end, we compare the raw image, the class average, and the reprojection from the 3D reconstruction, making sure that the 3D reconstruction is consistent. And then in the end, we just did all the labeling of the different subunits, and also with the help of Paul Penchak, we got a variance map and could localize the activator. And so that's kind of the things that you put in a publication. The end, the interpretation, the 3D map, all this is obvious, but you should put in the quality measures and put in raw data, at least to make me happy. And so that's pretty much all I have to say. Thank you. During my talk, thank you.
Or if you can hold the question to the end. The second thing I wanted to point out to the speakers is, unfortunately, a design flaw in this room, and that is that the lower third of the screen is very difficult to see by anyone asked about here. So if there's any way that the speakers could...
Richard, you need 5 minutes.
That's a terrible thing to ask people, but unfortunately, there's absolutely nothing we can do about it. You can all stand up at the back. Okay, so there are lots of contentious issues that were brought up there, and I'm sure there are questions. I see a forest of hands. Stan.
Tom, you said that there is no independent validation method to tell us whether our 3D structures are correct or not.
Other than X-ray structures that you can fit in, I think.
What about the Henderson and Rosenthal method? Richard, would you like to comment?
Well, I was going to put that in my talk.
Ah, something in a talk. Great.
I didn't mention that. But I talked to Richard, and he thinks that it's only an indication, doesn't really prove that it's the correct structure.
No, I would be a bit slightly bolder.
Okay.
Say that it shows that it doesn't prove that it's 100% correct.
I like the math.
But it does prove that it's not 100% wrong. And I mean, usually it'll mean that it's largely right. But I'll say something about that. We do need criteria that give you the number exactly.
Hi, just a comment rather than a question. Something I'd really like to see in people's publications are EMDB entry IDs for depositing the map, and also if you have a fitted model, the associated PDB ID.
I think more and more journals are asking for that, not necessarily requiring it, but at least asking for it.
I quite agree that probably the biggest power is to fit, to make atomic, pseudo-atomic models from envelopes of whatever resolution. I think what most, probably a lot of us appreciate, but most people don't appreciate, is that the fitting is much more accurate than the resolution. And do we have a way to quantitate our model relative to the map, or should we? You know what I mean?
There's a cross, well, so one of the issues that I have with this is if you have a density map and you have a crystal structure, I don't need it, I have one. If you have a density map and you have a crystal structure and the crystal structure actually doesn't fit into the density map, then you start to do flexible fitting. And I don't know where you have the courage to actually figure out that your density map is correct, that you can do flexible fitting. If you have sub-nanometer resolution and you start to see alpha helices, fine, but if you have a density map at 25 angstroms and you just start to modify the crystal structure so it fits into your density map, that's actually quite courageous in my view. But people have other opinions.
Well, there's some...
This is all being recorded?
Cross-collation. David.
Well, there are certain cases... there are certain cases where even at lower resolution, like 15 or so, you can really make a case that the structure that you observe is the true structure. I'm just referring to RF2 and RF1 release factors, which in the X-ray are found completely, you know, globular, in a globular shape, and it's stretched out. So there are cases where you can even...
I don't disagree. Yeah. If you have good biological evidence that conformation changes have to occur, for example, when toxins integrate into membranes, those conformation changes, I have no problem. But then there are other cases where I sometimes feel, well, if it doesn't fit, maybe a density map is not as good as you think.
Tom, I would also like to...
Fits very well.
I'd like you to also comment on the use of other methods which give you pretty good molecular envelopes, such as SACS, which can give you very, very similar information and could be used also, for instance, for verification.
Yeah, so to be honest, the only good SACS data I've ever seen is from David Agard. I have worked with a bunch of X-ray crystallographers who tried to do SACS, and their models kind of never fit with our EM. And we even wrote a grant on trying to do SACS and single particle, and the reviewer said, well, if you do single particle, why do you want to waste your time with SACS? And I kind of agree a little bit. David must have some trick that he gets his wonderful envelopes, but most people, the envelopes that I've seen by SACS really didn't make a hell of a lot of sense.
Yeah, I mean, I would disagree with that. I think we've seen some pretty good envelopes.
Oh, you have?
Yeah, we have, yeah.
Okay. Okay, I don't follow that field, so I just know my colleagues, and they were not very successful. David, do you want to comment?
Well, just to say that, like anything else, you know, it depends very much on what the details of the system are. In our case, both low-resolution negative stain maps were extraordinarily informative in terms of the biology, and agreed perfectly with the kinds of reconstructions we were getting de novo from SACS. So there was quite a lot of both commonality and also, you know, reinforcement of the data.
So how tricky is SACS for my education? Easy is it to get the correct structure? It's a lot of models that go in there, I thought.
It can be. It can be. Again, it depends very much on, you know, the shape. I mean, the more compact shapes go through, I think, the de novo reconstructions much better than extended shapes, where you tend to get distortions that show up
But again, if you have, you can do the pseudo-atomic model type approach, and that's worked extremely reliably for us, even allowing us to quantitate mixtures and multiple conformational states and deconvolve quite a lot out of the data. And it's, you know, the data collection, of course, is extremely trivial. So, you know, I mean, it's has tremendous benefits.
Do you need a lot of material?
So, I mean, it's a high concentration method, and the major problem is aggregation, of course, but your sort of mg per mil kinds of, or a couple mgs per mil concentration, you only need a, 50 microliter, 15 microliter, but there's some losses, right? And so, like, 25 microliter sample.
At the risk of being provocative, I have to say I'm in Tom's camp on this one, because in a sex experiment, where is the information coming from? You have no phases, you have no orientations, and you have a one-dimensional sort of monotonic curve. So where's the information coming from?
I was very impressed by what you showed. There is the crystal artifact at pH of 4, and then your stain work could actually show it. At least where I work, there is constant discussion about the pH of negative stain. I assume this is acetate or formate. So do you know, or you know, is there any study where they can actually show, does negative stain pH-wise affect your specimen preparation or not?
That's a good question. That's actually a big criticism all of us from negative staining, low pH. But Roger Craig had actually a very nice paper out that shows that your uniformate not only stains, it actually fixes your specimen very, very quickly. So before you induce any conformational change, pretty much everything is fixed. So first you adsorb it to the carbon film, which already keeps it in space, in shape, and then you come with a stain which fixes it. And so you're pretty, I believe that the pH is actually not a major issue in the staining. Roger Craig, it's, what was the paper?
The negative stain time resolve.
Yeah, the actin, myosin thing. Where was it published? Roger Craig.
So you mentioned that the graphics protocol would not work on all kind of molecules. And you named an elongated molecule. So was it elongated or was it a fiber? I would like to know.
We had two times when it really didn't work. Uh-huh. And so it was one complex that had a core complex, and then it had tethered little other complexes mm-hmm. to it. And we could see this in negative stain, and then we used graphics, and all the little tethered complexes collapsed into the main structure. And basically, it just became one big blob that didn't look anything like the unfixed structure. The other one was a tethering complex, which has elongated, three elongated legs, which you see nicely in normal negative stain. But then when you try graphics, all the legs, because they're flexible, once they touch, they get basically cross-linked together. And in the end, you have all the legs together in one big ball and not nicely extended as it is unfixed. So for these kind of things, graphics is not ideal.
It might be, okay.
But we like it a lot. We now try it with pretty much every sample.
When you have an EM map and you fit like a crystal structure in there, and once you're confident of the fitting, could you use the fitting to nudge the EM map into the direction of high resolution? I mean, just...
Well, it's kind of a circle.
I mean, you're biasing it, of course, but I mean, if it just catches on and it just, I don't know.
If your map is good enough that you can actually quite accurately dock your crystal structures in there, then you can take the density map and calculate the crystal structures, calculate the density map and make a new reference out of this. The problem is that you introduce bias because you use now your crystal structures. And the other thing is, if your density map is already that good, why should the X-ray structure be better? But that's my feeling, but other people probably have better answers to that. I actually would also be interested to hear that.
You mentioned a little bit about nanodisc technology. Mm-hmm. And can you actually make a comment if it can improve heterogeneity problem and the quality of image?
That's a good question. Nanodiscs are actually going to be very... Yeah, of course. Nanodiscs are going to be extremely good for NMR, actually. NMR is going to really catch up now with these nanodiscs. For single particle, it's not that great because the nanodiscs are actually not very homogeneous. The nanodisc itself has many different sizes. So we are using nanodiscs to try to work with membrane protein complexes to keep them together, but it's more out of desperation and not that the nanodisc is not going to make our life easier in terms of image processing. It just makes our life possibly easier in keeping the complexes together. But it's the nanodisc preparation itself is heterogeneous, so it's not, it's going to introduce even more heterogeneity.
So there was a question about X-ray structures fitted into densities and whether that would help. So I don't really have a definite answer to this, except that in X-ray crystallography, I think once you can fit atoms into your density, then this means sort of a change of game, and you are, then you can really improve your resolution. And I wonder if something like this can also be done in EM. I'm not quite sure how.
But this is basically a very high resolution technique when then the chemistry of the molecules come into
exactly.
play.
Exactly. But I mean, still, when you have an X-ray structure, that would also exclude certain or would restrain the possible densities. As I said, I don't really know how, but I can imagine that maybe once one figures something out, it would be useful. Just so, And then the other thing that I wanted to say about your talk, one of the main issues to me is really how to make structures reliable and whether it's totally wrong or partially wrong, how to measure resolution and so on. So I think this is something that once figured out, which would advance the field.